Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Entrepreneur Architect Podcast, episode 27. Welcome to this episode of the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. Architecture school graduating classes consist of approximately 50% men and 50% women. But somewhere along the way to licensure, 32% of the women drop out of the profession to pursue other paths. Why does this gender gap exist? What are those women doing if they're not pursuing architecture? Where did they go? My guest this week on the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast is on a mission to find out. Architect Rosa Shang is a member of the board of directors at AIA San Francisco and leads the committee called the Missing 32%. Their mission is to investigate what is causing this disparity between men and women architects and to support the women who do decide to pursue their passion for architecture. This is a very interesting topic, and Rosa has lots to share, so I'm going to get right into the interview. Rosa Shang, welcome to the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark.
It's
glad to be here.
It's great having you here.
Likewise.
I like to start off with my guests on the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast by asking them to introduce themselves and to talk a little bit about what inspired you to become an architect and your journey from that point all the way through to what you're doing today.
Sure. So it's kind of interesting because I knew I wanted to become an architect at an early age of 11. Usually people decide later on in high school, but when I went to visit my grandparents in China at the age of 11, my grandfather was very proactive in showing me the history of Chinese architecture, as he knew I enjoyed art and different environments. But when we went to the Great Wall and also the Forbidden City, there was a viewpoint on top of a hill where we were looking across this great panorama of Beijing. And he basically emphasized that that was an intentional act and it was designed, you know, and there were designers and people that actually planned this whole thing out. It wasn't just something that happened by accident. And that's the point I realized that, wow, there's such a great impact and a long-lasting impact to be made on the built environment at that point. I don't think I could articulate it that way, but it was definitely something that was a light bulb of, aha, I could do this. This would be really amazing. So he always encouraged me, to the point of his death, to become an architect much to the dismay of my parents and my other relatives, who said, oh, you can't make any money that way. You should be a doctor or a lawyer or something else. But the more they pushed, the more I dug in my heels, so to speak. So I went on to study architecture at Syracuse University. And from there, after graduating, I started working in Philadelphia as an architect. It was really difficult at that time because it was a recession back in 1994. And there wasn't much going on in the East Coast as far as new construction. I was doing work with retail malls as well as retail outlet stores, the kind of, you know, fake towns, if you will, of the time. They're trying to recreate a new urbanism, but with staged retail, kind of Disney-esque. And a friend of mine was working in Pittsburgh for Bull & Swinsky Jackson, and said, you should, you know, try to come out here. There's some projects out west that are pretty interesting, one of them being Pixar Animation Studios. And that was kind of the impetus for coming to California. And a bunch of us from the Pittsburgh office ended up founding the San Francisco office out here, born out of the Pixar project. We were fortunate enough to work closely with Steve Jobs. And from that, after that project, we started working on the Apple retail stores, and the first one being the Apple, the Soho store in New York, with the glass staircase, and the whole minimal aesthetic that you know today started from that project in particular, and continues on today. From that, there was a series of Apple retail stores that we worked on together. The last one that I worked on was the Glass Cube at Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, I know that well. Been there many times.
So concurrently, I had my first child. I was pregnant with my first child during that project. So I finished up the contract documents, and it was built, you know, as I was on maternity leave. But then the great thing was when I went back out of maternity leave, I was invited to the store opening in Fifth Avenue. The entire family was invited. And there was a kind of celebratory dinner of the design team. And Steve approached me and he said, yeah, I'd like you to come to dinner with us. I really appreciate all the work that you've done for the retail stores. And I was flattered, but at the same time torn, because I had my family with me, my husband and my then 9-month-old daughter. So I declined and I said, I'm really flattered, but I can't because I have my family. And he's like, oh, that's too bad. So I thought that was the end of it. And then later on that day, he came over and he said, I've got another place. I got an extra seat for your husband, but you'll have to find a babysitter. There's no kids coming tonight. And again, you know, just extremely flattered but torn. You know, I can't possibly leave, you know, my young child, you know, so I have to decline again, but thank you again. And then the shocking thing was, at the end of the day, he comes up to me in this sea of people in the middle of the store opening, and he says, all right, you drive a hard bargain, so here's the deal. She can come, but if she poops or pees, or if you breastfeed, she's out. So we ended up going to dinner. I accepted. And it was kind of a lesson learned of negotiation for me, of standing up for what I believe in.
Yeah.
And, you know, putting priorities first. But also, it was a great privilege to know that he respected me for those decisions. And, you know, throughout our kind of working rapport with our whole entire team and the Apple team, that there was this kind of mutual respect of working hard, but then also, you know, understanding life's values, which I don't think came across very much in, you know, the stories about him, but that's one of the personal stories that I hold
dear. Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
It's certainly not what you expect to hear when you hear the name Steve Jobs.
No, not at all. So after that, I retired from the Apple retail store design part of it. But then I was very fortunate in that concurrently, there was a project for Mills College, which is primarily a women's college in Oakland, California, that is basically older than Stanford. And I didn't realize that at the time. But they only have co-ed graduate programs. So the business school there started about, let's say, almost 15 years ago. And it was doing really well. At the time, they had a donor, Lori Iloki, who gifted them enough to do a proper building that was concurrent with their program goals of socially responsible business practices and sustainability. And we won the project in an interview process where they said, you know, we really appreciate you being a woman and a leader in the firm, and presented as the project manager. And all the same time, coming back from maternity leave, there was a large group of women on the client side, which was refreshing. Most of the time, you know, the profession is male dominated. So that was my first glimpse at what equity, you know, could be in a kind of utopian scenario. So the project was innovative and sustainable. It's won a bunch of design awards for sustainability. It achieved LEED Gold as the first business school building in California to achieve LEED Gold. So that was a major milestone for the college itself. And then fast forward, the economy, you know, tanked with the last major recession. So at the end of the project, I had my second child, and I was coming back out of maternity leave. And it was quite a challenge at that time, that the first time I experienced it, where there wasn't an immediate project thereafter. And there was a lot of experience in marketing and new business development and kind of stretching outside of my comfort zone, if you will. But because there was a lack of new projects, there's a lot of, helping out on other projects, which I don't mind at all. I'm experienced with specifications and contracts and contract negotiations. So I was able to help out on a bunch of projects, including a conference center for UCLA and a bunch of corporate Apple work, which, you know, is top secret and I can't really talk about in detail, but we did some limited interior renovations within their corporate practice in Cupertino as well as other locations. So that was a good experience, and being able to go back to people I worked with before and kind of help them with their, you know, their interior projects at the workplace level. And then from there, currently, I'm working on back onto university work with projects for Dominican University of California in San Rafael and UC Davis. Currently, we're working on a new lecture hall in the programming stages. So mostly in the programming work right now, but you could see there, in most people's cases, there's a climb out of the recession, and there's a lot of projects, but they're smaller projects, or they're not as robust as they were before. And then you're seeing a lot of programming and planning happening. But again, the challenge is getting past the programming stage into the actual building stage again. So, in that mindset, I've been doing a lot of just observation and tracking my own career. I spoke at a conference last June called The Missing 32%. Hosted by the AIA San Francisco. I was on a panel called Building Your Communication and Negotiation Skills with a panel of other women, some principals, and somebody who works with architects as far as being able to present themselves in an interview situation. And it was well received, and the conversations at the symposium itself were very diverse, but they kind of led to the question of, well, why isn't this conversation happening more often? You know, with the controversy over Denise Scott Brown and the Pritzker Prize and subsequent publications and articles that have come out lean in from Sheryl Sandberg to there's a local author named Katrina Alcorn. There's a book she published called Maxed Out, which talks about the kind of societal demands on, you know, modern day women trying to do it all and then burning out because of it, you know, on the counterpoint to lean in Sheryl Sandberg's proposal that you have to, you know, get in the game and continue that way. So it's been really interesting doing the research and observing, but also understanding that there's a need immediately in the Bay Area and also nationally for this conversation to continue in order for us to reach gender equity as a goal. I don't know if we'll ever get there, but I'm hopeful that now is a nascent point where on the national movement, you have the Equal Pay Act, there's a couple of bills in place in Congress even to help try to equalize what is perceived as, you know, the gender gap. Should I pause or should I keep going?
Well, it's a very interesting story. Let's just focus in on the missing 32%.
Sure.
Explain what that is.
Yes.
And you described a little bit about how it happened, but talk about what it is and its mission today.
Sure. So the name itself came out of a statistic that was, I guess, 3 years back that was provided by AIA National, and it had to do with the fact that when men and women graduate from architecture programs, it's roughly 50-50 men and women coming out of those programs. The startling statistic is that for AIA, 18% of those women are tracked as being licensed. And again, it's AIA and it's not a broader survey of sorts,
right,
but still it's pretty startling as a drop-off point where you think in modern day society it should be closer to 50-50. So therefore the 32% is, you know, simple math of subtract 18 from the 50 and 32 are unaccounted for. And I think the title was pretty compelling in getting people to raise the red flag that there is an issue, because most people don't believe that there is one. I think for the longest time it was kind of, there's a lot in the camp of, well, I don't need to be recognized as a woman architect to practice architecture. I can just work hard and therefore that should be the solution. But obviously it's not. And even, you know, when we heard the statistic originally, there was a lot of disbelief, but then we actually looked around our own office and there is, you know, there's a couple of there's three women at the senior leadership level that are titled. There's a lot of new interns coming in, but then there's this huge swath in the middle of just a desert of, you know, women that have left the practice or have left the firm. So we're dealing with those challenges in our own firm, just trying to figure out, you know, what the problems are, but also how to support women in staying on. And part of the research of the 32% was to provide the background to have that conversation, because a lot of it is hypothesis. So we thought having a legitimate survey starting from there and having statistics that aren't readily available in the US. They have started a study in Australia, which is 2 years ahead of us. And they actually were able to publish the survey results, establish best practice guidelines, and get their Australian AIA to adopt an equity in architecture policy in November. So to me, that's kind of like the gold standard, and we're kind of trying to figure out how they did it and, you know, model our efforts after theirs, because we think that it's exemplary that they were able to accomplish their goals in such a compact amount of time. But obviously there's a resounding need by both men and women to have more balance, you know, in the work environment, both in gender, but also in practice of work-life quality and flexibility that I think is currently lacking.
Right. The survey is how you and I connected. We connected on Twitter.
Yes.
And I saw the survey going around on Twitter, and I contributed to that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I tried to, you know, promote it as much as I could. Have you published those results yet?
They are still in the, so we have a team of researchers at Mills College, statisticians and students that are under the guidance of the head professor there, who are currently processing the information. Mm-hmm. So it's not a, you know, kind of push the button and out comes the response, but there is a bit of cleaning up to do and interpretation based on half filled out answers and whatnot.
Right.
So we're constantly checking in with them, but the goal is to have a completed set of data by the end of, a raw data anyway, by the end of May or early June. And then our group of the missing 32% will be trying to package that in a digestible way in the form of infographics mm-hmm. of the key statistical findings. And the full report would be available probably at the same time as our symposium in the fall that we're currently planning. So a set of, and it would launch the kind of discussion of best practices. And we're, so we called the survey Equity in Architecture, and the symposium will be called Equity by Design, which is, again, launching that effort to seek out best practices to be able to publish that in some form as a way for firms to start thinking about equity and having those difficult conversations, but also trying to implement good practice guidelines to keep the best talent from leaving architecture.
So the committee is an AIA San Francisco initiative, right?
Yes. Yes, but the survey itself started out as being a local initiative, and then because of the momentum we're getting and the interest, we opened that up to a national survey. So it's not as robust as it would be if we started out as a national survey, but I think we ended up with almost 2,300 responses. We're a little bit under, but pretty close to that.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great response. So the committee is still running it, right?
The
San Francisco committee. And
correct.
And the committee's mission really is to do research to figure out what is causing this gap.
That's correct.
And then create some sort of support resources for whatever you find so it can change, right? That's basically
yes,
the mission.
Absolutely. And if you visit our website, which is www.themissing32%, as spelled out, not the symbol for percent.com, you'll find a lot of resources already in place. We viewed having a website as a way for a platform for the dialogue to happen. So we have a whole area on research that's been done already as a way to link to those research findings, different articles written about why women leave architecture. So we try to collect all those articles as a way for people to not have to start finding them themselves, but as a resource in that starting that dialogue.
Right, that's a great resource.
Thank you. And what we also hope to have is another part of it is just recognizing the people that inspire us. So in the future, we're going to have video and audio interviews with women at different stages of their career who are, you know, doing something slightly differently or have a compelling story that would speak to other women and motivate them in the profession, because oftentimes you hear that there's a lack of women role models. So we figure, well, if we have them virtually, people can tap into these stories and find inspiration and kind of tips and tools of how to overcome some of their challenges.
Right. I think, entrepreneur architect focuses mainly on sole proprietors and small firms. And I think that's that part of architecture is certainly one way for women to continue in the profession. Because, you know, from what I see, my wife is my partner. And one of the reasons we started Five Cat Studio, which is our firm, we have our own firm, and we currently now work from our own home. We started in the home, and we moved out of the house, and for 11 years worked in a local studio, built it into a nice medium-sized firm, or small firm, really. It's always been a small firm. And in November, we decided to go virtual and move our staff to their own remote studios. And we work from our own remote studio. And we do everything through the internet. And one of the reasons why we started Five Cat Studio right from the beginning was so that we could raise our family. We have three kids, and we knew that we wanted to both be architects and continue being architects, and have our own, have our family at the same time. And we did sacrifice the, guiding, growing in a larger firm in order to sure. do what we do. But we also, have the opportunity to stay being architects and to be very involved in our own family. And so I could see that being one solution, certainly, because it's a way for women architects who become mothers, because from my experience, that's probably, and it may be supported by your survey, that's probably the number one reason why women leave the profession, is because they leave to become mothers. And then it's either difficult to get back in from the outside, or from the inside, as mothers, they're torn on whether they want to go back because they want to be mothers and they want to be architects. And there's no solution to that, to be both. Do you find that that's something that's repeated in your research?
Yeah, I guess it depends on the circumstance. So you're right, there are other alternatives for women. And actually, that's been pretty historic, is that women tend to practice on their own or in small firms doing residential architecture. And there was an interesting article written by Tara Imani, who cited very early on, in the kind of formation of the AIA itself, that unfortunately, for whatever reason, residential architecture was not viewed as architecture with a capital A. Mm-hmm. It was viewed as like a subsidiary. And from that period on, it wasn't legitimate. Women practicing architecture on a residential scale wasn't viewed as legitimate at that point. And for some reason, that hopefully is different today, but you could still see how some of that stigma still carries on in the way we recognize architects and their work. And I hope that changes going forward, with social media, the accessibility of self-reporting and what right. you're doing is really admirable, I think, and a lot of other architects, such as Neil Pan and Enoch Sears, and trying to elevate the kind of the day-to-day architect and not your starchitect, right?
Right.
But I think there are opportunities for women who want to choose to practice at larger medium-sized firms, but the problem is, or the solution I should say, is having the network, the support system in place at those firms,
right?
Choosing the right firms, being very selective when you're interviewing, and observing not only the current design opportunities available to you, but the kind of structure when you're going into a firm, and really talking to the people that work there and figuring out all those things that you're going to want later on, not immediately in the firm, but if you do stay, what is the policy for on-ramping and off-ramping and working outside of the office, telecommuting, flexible work schedules? We're really fortunate here in that the firm is very supportive, that if you come up with a plan on how you're going to on-ramp and off-ramp, so to speak, they will support you. And I've been really lucky in that I've managed the Mills Graduate School of Business project. I basically did between two children, which normally in a larger firm or a firm that support women in that way would say, forget about it. You can't be a project manager of that, that size of a project. But seeing that I was committed to doing it and that I came up with a plan in order for that to happen. A lot of the work also happens at night. So strategically planning when I'm in the office, how to work effectively, working smarter, having the kind of face-to-face critical things happen during work hours. And then a lot of it has to do with, the mommy midnight shift, as it's called, or, when the parent has to go home and carry on work after hours, writing emails, doing specifications, things that don't require that face-to-face interaction. We're, you know, fortunate in that technology has advanced that we can have go-to meetings now, and a lot of the interactions that allow you to, you and your firm to carry on virtually is something that I think the larger firms are getting more comfortable with. So I think the idea of having a go-to meeting with a consultant or the client, they're getting more used to that, lends itself to saying, well, you know, I can have that kind of touch-base meeting at home in the morning or, you know, later in the afternoon. Doesn't preclude that you're not an invested worker just because you can't put in the physical hours, you know, at the office. It's just figuring out a way to do it effectively.
Right. I think that as the internet matures,
yes,
and the tools become more available and more accepted, it may be interesting to see the small firms lead the way with this, and the larger firms learn from what the smaller firms are doing, because I think that's a big part of the solution to allow families and businesses to sort of become integrated, where we have integrated lives, where our the design side of us and the parent side of us can start to merge, which is what small firms are doing. That's what we've done from the beginning, and the internet tools are allowing us to do that even more. I don't call it a work-life balance. I call it an integrated life, where some you know, we do it. We work very flexible hours, you know, from a larger firm's perspective, if they moved from the number of hours we worked in a studio, basing our compensation on the number of hours we worked, to the amount of work that we get done and the quality of that work, it will allow both men and women to be more flexible in what they do and the lives of their families, and be much happier employees.
Definitely.
And I see that already happening in small firms.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I guess my kind of goal in the practice is to modernize the way we do things with technology to help that, to encourage that, to that flexibility to occur. It also helps because a lot of projects that we as architects do these days are not in our home base, in our immediate neighborhood. They just happen to be somewhere else. So, you know, being able to bridge that gap with technology not only helps ourselves, but helps the project. So I'm a big proponent and a champion for implementing software that, you know, modernizes some antiquated practices, such as, you know, during CA, having to physically send each submittal as a hard copy or stamp that and then, you know, photocopy it 5 or 6 times and then send it back to each of distribution, right? A lot of that now is taken care of online with cloud-based software, where you're doing virtual PDF approvals of submittals and being able to upload them, download them easily, and having the whole team be able to collaborate is something that's really important. It's changed the way we do business here.
Yeah, it's a very interesting it's a very interesting subject for me, because it'll be interesting as it grows and as your research and your survey develops to see how the two become intertwined, that the issue of equity in architecture and this new virtual virtual firms,
right,
sort of come together and almost solve each other's problems. And it just,
that would be great, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And it may just, you know, through the research and the focus that you're doing, will make, you know, shine a light on it. And the tools may just happen at the right time for things to happen that way.
Absolutely.
And it'll be very interesting to see where it goes. I know that you're on a hard deadline coming up here. So, I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Is there anything else that you want to share before you go?
Yes, there was an interesting article that I read this morning from the Atlantic that I'll forward to you. but it's about confidence, or, you know, women being able to have confidence in what their ability to do things that I thought was an eye-opener, because I don't oftentimes think about it that way. But in the article itself, it presents these various examples where, you know, where if you're, for example, if you're going after a job and there's a bunch of check boxes, a guy will have about 5 of the 10 check boxes, like, I have these covered, you know, I'm proficient, and then he'll wing the rest. Whereas a woman, if she doesn't have all 10 check boxes, she won't go after the job. So there's a big hurdle in terms of confidence and supporting women in developing confidence that is often challenged, you know, during these key milestones in your life, that we can help develop and instill, that outside of just having the flexibility of technology in the workplace, it's really changing the way we teach our children to grow up and to think about themselves, you know, for future generations, but also to understand ourselves and the kind of, you know, personal skeletons in our closet that we face that keep us from achieving our goals and our dreams.
I love it. I could talk I could talk for hours more.
We'll talk again, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would love to.
Maybe when you have the report published, I'd love to get into it a little more and talk about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great.
Thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for
being
with
Mark.
Me. Okay.
Yeah. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
So what are your thoughts on this topic? Where are the women in architecture? Maybe they're just smarter than the guys and they left the profession to pursue avenues with greater potential. That's just a joke. Don't send me any email on that. Maybe they became mothers and they decided that motherhood was more important. Or maybe they left to become mothers and when they wanted to come back, they weren't welcomed back. I'm married to a woman architect. Anne-Marie, who's my partner, who is also the mother to our children, I see how hard it is to do both. Even with the firm structure that we've built at Five Cat Studio to allow us to contribute to both our firm and our family, it's not easy. It's a very difficult problem to solve. It'll be very interesting to see how the internet affects the gender gap as web-based collaboration tools mature and it becomes more acceptable to build a firm with flexible work hours. And as business models based on merit and skill become more commonplace than hours-based models, it'll be very interesting to see if the gap begins to close. I look forward to seeing the results of the missing 32% survey and maybe inviting Rosa to come back to share her findings. I hope that we can work that out. So I'm sure you have your own opinion on this topic. So go to entrearchitect.com/episode27 and leave a comment. I'd love to continue this conversation over at the blog, so leave a comment over there and we'll keep this thing going. And before I wrap up, I want to say thank you to SoCoQ. So I apologize if I messed up your name, SoCoQ, but you left a review over on iTunes for the blog and I wanted to just say thank you and a 5-star rating. That's awesome. I appreciate all the reviews and the ratings that the podcast has received. We're up to 32 ratings and 21 reviews now. That's awesome. That means so much to me. I love to read what you think of the show. If you want to leave a review, go to entrearchitect.com/iTunes, and that link will take you right to the iTunes page where you can leave your thoughts. So I would love for you to go do that. And I want to say thank you again to Rosa Shang for spending some time with us here on the podcast. She is very busy, and it took some time to coordinate our schedules. We were on and off for a couple of weeks. But she is a leader in the profession, and I wanted to give her an opportunity to share her message, and I'm glad we connected, and I look forward to speaking with her again in the future. So that's a wrap this week. Until next week, my name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Thank you so much for listening.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.